You're listening to First Wall Rebate. Shane Hinton with me as always are Trevor Dodge and Sean Ryder.
Hey, hey.
Hello.
And we're getting the band back together after several months of inactivity. And joining us for that very special episode is longtime friend, compatriot, kind of common thinker, Corvus Elrod, who is, and I'm going to read a little bit here off of a bio that I found online earlier, an improvisational storyteller with over 20 years professional experience, applying his trade in theater stages, street corners, searching for ways to craft stories that are more meaningful to his audience. And I think that that itself is a very great, is a great takeoff really to a lot of the work that, you know, we're looking at, we'll be talking about of yours tonight, Corvus. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and we're really looking forward to the conversation.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. Like, we should definitely have done this a long time ago. I don't know why it's taken us, you know, nearly 2 years to have you on. You and Trevor have had some interaction in the past out beautiful Portland, Oregon, and I think in coordinating with some of the classes that Trevor's taught. So this is a long time coming. But to get into it, first of all, tonight, I think we should get started. We're going to talk about tabletop RPGs, as we've been talking about kind of in our pre-show chatter. So Corvus, why don't you bring us into it? Tell us a little bit about your experience with and your passion for tabletop RPGs and where that comes from, and what do you feel that their importance is to, you know, narrative discoveries that we might be making even now, 30, 35, 40 years after their conception. Initial conception.
Wow. Go back a little before RPGs, yeah, and even just talk about board games. Because my very first experiences and fascination with games and how people relate to each other through games comes from just playing Sari and Parcheesi. And my personal favorite as a child was a game called Masterpiece. Have any of you played
that? No.
So this is a game where you actually bought works of art.
Yes, I do remember this one.
There were little clips that had monetary values. So you might buy something that's a forgery, so it's not worth anything. You might buy a painting that's worth a lot of money. And then you have to decide you want a good portfolio of art in your hand. So you have to try to sell off the bad art and buy the good art from other people. And it was a game I was really good at as a kid, even though I stubbornly only ever bought art that I liked. But I mean, that's where most people really start developing a fascination with gaming at a young age, is with just a board game. And it usually has to do with family, or maybe it's a game your friend had. Maybe you played Dark Tower over at a friend's house, or. But really, and in those board games, which we tend to forget about, particularly in the video game world, I don't think we really like to talk about our dirty, shameful past of board games. Like, that's just some esoteric thing that Germans do with little wood houses, right? Board games. I mean, nobody really does those anymore, right? But it's so important because there's similarities to the way we relate to each other across board games, as well as video games, and in the way the mechanics work, and what they sort of inspire in us as we interrelate with those game mechanics themselves. There's not as much difference between the playing God of War and playing chess.
Yeah, what you say really reminds me of my own earliest experiences with board games, and sort of more, I don't know, conventional things like with Monopoly and Sari and Clue. But I think everybody's got a family story of incredible shame of the night that the Monopoly game went too long and everybody like got really angry and upset and started, you know, divorcing each other over it. And it's really interesting how what you just said about mechanics plays so much into that, because of course the, you know, the end goal of Monopoly is literally to drive the other players off of the map in kind of not very subtle ways, you know. So that social, you know, negation is almost inherent to that particular game. And so many people play it and love it here in the United States. It makes perfect sense, you know. Put it in the backdrop of the economic meltdown we're experiencing right now. It's like, yeah, well, we told you so a long time ago.
Didn't you play Monopoly? Did you see this coming? Yeah, so, and like, so one of the things that I was thinking about this today when I was sort of getting my brain geared up for the podcast, that anybody who doubts that games themselves are capable of communicating story, like, think about if Candyland had all the characters from Clue in it, but the same mechanic as Candyland. Like, it wouldn't be a popular game because there's no mystery. So going back and just looking at these simple games and like, how do they communicate what they communicate and what is their point is, I think, really integral to our expectations of games, even if we're not consciously aware of it as gamers.
That's an interesting point to bring up, because earlier you know, compared playing God of War and chess, which I don't necessarily argue with the comparison at all, but one thing that I find interesting is that, you know, board games largely are considered these kind of family experiences. And, you know, Trevor goes immediately to the family example, and I have lots of those examples in my family, and it makes sense on one level, but I wonder how that ties in with, you know, what are the limitations of the sorts of stories that can be conveyed kind of in that medium, and how does that, it seems like an obvious connection as well to sort of criticisms that people make about video games.
About video games being more solitary experiences?
Well, about just sort of the kind of societal urge to put them into a family-friendly kind of category, you know, in spite of the fact that video games aren't really experienced as often in that kind of familial atmosphere.
Right. I think that's changing to a large degree, though. And yeah, I think that's the generational thing that's going away.
I completely agree. I think as we grow up and have families, we don't necessarily stop playing games, and things like the Wii are definitely bringing that together, and the intergenerational gaming, something that I think a few years ago you would have never actually said, right?
Right, yeah. Like I like to tell a story about my mother-in-law visiting us after we got our Wii, my wife and I, and we played Wii bowling and Wii tennis for the entire trip, and it's probably one of the best visits we've ever had. And a month later, she calls and says, so one of the salespeople in my company is going to bring in Guitar Hero, and we're going to have a competition, and I want to make sure that I know what I'm doing and don't embarrass myself. So can I make another visit in February, and you guys teach me how to play Guitar Hero? So she visited like almost immediately after the holidays for another great 4-day visit where we just played Guitar Hero for 4 days straight.
Wow.
And it was awesome. Like, I mean, that's exactly the sort of experiences that games have traditionally provided.
I have a related story kind of with the old media. A couple years back, my brother is a ranked game master in the RPGA, but sadly didn't own his own copy of Catan. So a while back, I bought him a nice box set of Catan for Christmas, and we got it all out around the table and played it one night. And then I came back from my visit, and a few weeks later, I had heard that my mom had gone to Toys R Us and bought a box of Catan, and was excited because next year we would have it there to be able to start kind of playing a new kind of family game.
Well, I think that somewhat connected to that, and also trying to bring into the discussion more the initiative towards narrative and storytelling, which obviously is something that you practice and deliberately try to go after, right, Corvus, is we're telling family holiday stories. My parents, my mother in particular, loathed board games, still does, hates them with like a real passion. But for some reason, one Christmas we were able to talk both her and my dad and my then fiance and now wife into playing Axis and Allies. I don't know how that ended up happening, but what play one of the most one of the games that has certainly exposed
reverse
all the
psychology
that you hate about
I see
it. Both my wife and I were in college studying history, and she was majoring in it and I was minoring in it, and we were very, very, of course, sort of smitten with this notion of the board game becoming a what if narrative. So you have this beginning state, and it's 1941, and the political borders are drawn a certain way, and all the resources are allocated in a certain way, and then both strategy and chance and deal making tells this alternative story of World War II. And so while it's still the game is obviously driving towards an end state with a winner. And those things are always played into board games, and that's a large reason why you play them. But you're kind of building a story together about something, a set of facts and a history that is largely agreed upon already. The Allies won, and that's the way it was, and that's the way it should have been, or whatever. But the board game allows this opportunity to say, well, what if that didn't happen exactly the way that we remember it, or what are the things that may have caused that to happen the way that it did? And I think that the work that you do, Corvus, certainly offers up games as sort of possibility spaces, if I can use that term in here. And I wonder if that's where you eventually found yourself with RPG work.
Well, so what's interesting is I've been running RPGs since 1989, I think was the first time I was ever asked to actually run a game, and I haven't stopped since. And it was really much more that at the time was actually more of an extension of my performance background and sort of that desire to do improvisational work and then finding structures that sort of supported that and kept everybody in check and introduced risk, a little bit of danger. So that you weren't just saying, well, now I'm going to go jump off the skyscraper and land on the bad guy's car if it wasn't a superhero campaign, So what I find that question really interesting is, like, if that comes from sort of the board game thing, is I've actually found in the last several years now, as I've been really formalizing my RPG system, it's become more and more board game like, the mechanics and the rule set is to support the performative space. So it's not complex numbers and math on a page anymore. It's tokens on an actual, cardstock, heavy cardstock board with big, pretty hexagons on it, bright colors and icons with various meanings. So, I definitely think that it ties in, but it kind of came in the back door almost, ironically.
It might be easy to kind of point to the ways that video game RPGs would be very limited in scope in comparison to a tabletop RPG of the type that you're just talking about. But I wonder in what ways you might see them as actually opening up spaces that don't exist in those more traditional RPGs.
So to get into my problem with what we tend to think of as video game RPGs, we actually can go right back and get into what I think my problem with most tabletop RPGs is. And that's that they have really unnecessarily complex rule structures designed to keep you from being awesome. And that's specifically if you look at the development of RPGs and the rule balancing and what they do, it's all designed, or traditionally has been designed, to try to say, no, you can't do that. No, I'm sorry, that doesn't work. No, that's not allowed. And it's really, like, that mentality really comes through in World of Warcraft, mm-hmm. where my level 3 gnome rogue can't eat a cherry pie because he's not high enough level to eat a cherry pie. And that makes that makes no sense. Like, there is no narrative explanation why really sweet food is out of the grasp of low-level characters.
That's a class issue, Corvus. It's all about the act. Yeah.
And so, and to me, that's just like the most ludicrous expression of, well, wizards can't wear armor. Well, you know, that's like saying little girls can't put on their mother's dresses and high-heeled shoes. Of course they can. They don't fit well. They don't walk easily. They're probably going to trip. They might tear their clothes, but they can still put them on. There's something that stops. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of RPGs focus way too much on saying, here's the experience I want you to have, and here are all the rules that ensure that's the experience you're going to have. And I think that's endemic of tabletop RPGs and video game RPGs.
Yeah, I think you're really onto something there. Because now, I don't mean to keep dragging us back into the sort of play world of just the traditional tabletop games that, you know, we played as children, but just what you just said about you know, limiting what a character can do with these very arbitrary rules, and the sort of social norming that happens as a result of that. Leads me immediately to think about a game session that I had with my my 8-year-old son. We were playing Milton Bradley's Life just a couple of months ago, and I hadn't played this game in forever and a day. And he got it for a gift or something, and we started playing it. And I was absolutely abhorred by the sort of binary juxtaposition of things in the game that you immediately are asked to make these sort of impossible life choices from the very, very beginning. And they're completely binary ones. Do you want to go to college or do you want to go to the workforce? And it's not that they're like unrealistic ones or they're ones that are unfamiliar to us, but it's like, that's all you can do. You can either work or you can go to college. And then of course there's literally, you know, you get in the car, that's the movement around the board. And you have first, you have to gender identify. You either pick a blue piece or a pink piece, and then you have to get married. You absolutely, positively have to get married. And at that point, I actually had a discussion with my son who didn't want to get married. He's like, I don't want to do that right now. Why do I have to do that? It's like, well, because you're in front of a church and it says stop, get married, and literally pick up another piece that is a different color from yours and put it in the car. And, you know, eventually, if you play this game enough, you know, far enough, you're going to, you know, pick up some children, and basically your life is driving around in a car with someone of the opposite sex, you know, accumulating wealth and job experience, and hopefully you make it to Millionaire Acres. And it's like, wow, what a completely, you know, narrow point of view that is taught to, you know, to kids from a very early age, if this is what is going to be expected of you in the world to some extent.
The things that both of you are talking about are also seem to be related a lot kind of with the necessary abstraction that has to happen in I mean, pretty much any game system, any rule system, where, you know, reality is so complex, we make games, but it's or we make sets of rules that simplify it so that we can move through experiences that in some ways reflect our lives and our worlds. I'm curious, you know, because from a graphical standpoint, I mean, obviously video games have been improving dramatically and, you know, can render incredible visuals. We've seen some experiments in certain games, you know, like a Molyneux's Fable series comes to mind immediately in terms of like actually evolving a character through the actual actions that you take with the character. I'm curious, Corvus, what your thoughts are about kind of the idea that maybe the dropping away of kind of the rule sets in favor of a more direct modeling of not necessarily some reality, but possibly some unreality. as a sort of an approach to doing a future of role playing games? Or
Well, so you mentioned Fable, which I actually love the Fable games. I even really adored the first one, even though it was hopelessly flawed. And at no point did I ever feel those were set against me to try and restrict me and keep me from doing things. That's a rule structure that existed predominantly to allow you to be cool in a way that made sense to you. And particularly in the second game, where it left so much up to the player to interpret their experience that I think a lot of people felt it was kind of a hollow game, or they didn't quite get as much meaning out of it because they didn't realize that it was something they needed to invest. So they approached the social sandbox aspects of that game as a game mechanic that they had to figure out, because this is what they've been trained to do by RPGs. I've got to figure out the exploit to make this work in my favor. And so you dive into town and you dance until everybody's got a ring or a gift over their head, and then you do fun flirty animations and you get gifts and you exploit these systems, because we've been trained by games that that's the only way to be successful, is to find the weak point and exploit it in your favor. And then they complain, well, it's not very realistic. You can just go in town and make everybody love you right away. Well, sure, but you danced for how long? Like, how long of your time did you waste just sitting there dancing? That isn't behaving in a natural way. That's not interacting with the system in a way that's consistent with the way the system's really trying to interact with you. And I think we're seeing more and more games that are really actually trying to sort of do that on some level. Far Cry 2, even though I had some issues with some of the design choices in that game, I have to give Clint Hocking just huge props for using the first-person shooter conceits in a way that allowed you to just sort of experiment. And that was at the story level. That's the way the narrative unfolded, too, from what I could tell from playing it, is that it's just sort of, I don't know, go see what you make of it. Which, again, I think is why it didn't have the appeal of, you know, like the broad market appeal of a game that really goes, nope, here's the experience you're going to have. Look, there's a creepy little girl mind-controlling robots. Go kill robots, you know. So I think it's a growth thing in the industry right now, and they're trying to broaden the appeal. Much like, think about chess for a second. The queen is the most powerful piece in chess, and she's available from your second move.
Well, I have to agree with you about Fable as much as it kills me. I still haven't forgiven Peter Molyneux for killing my dog.
So that's a really interesting thing, because I wanted to like that dog, and it felt so much like a mechanic to me throughout the entire game. Running and seeing treasure, and I didn't emotionally connect to the dog. And I finished it first as a good character, which is unusual for me. I usually finish it first as an evil character. But there was a thing that happened midway through that I couldn't process well, because my evil character was actually wanted everyone to like her as well. So she was just evil because she was anyway. And there was a point where I had to kill a bunch of villagers, and I kind of freaked out and restarted the game as a good character. But so when the dog died, I'm like, oh, no big deal. I don't mind that the dog's missing. And when I got to the tower and I made my big final decision, I didn't make a decision that brought the dog back to me. And then wandering around afterwards, I found that I really missed the dog.
Huh. Yeah.
Because I'd come to rely on the mechanics the dog provided. So I was treating it like a work dog. So I felt like very much like here I was, you know, like if you're on a farm, if you grew up on a farm around dogs, dogs are functional. They're not pets. and you don't really miss them until they're not there fulfilling their function anymore. And that was very much, Sable kind of snuck up behind me and got me to like the dog after the fact. It was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, games like Fable that, like as you're saying, want to rely less on textual or spoken narrative and want to kind of allow you to create a relationship with an environment, or even in Fable's case, like with non-player characters in an environment that are handled, I felt like were handled in a really interesting way in Fable 2, for them to be, all of your interactions to be abstracted to, like you're talking about, to these very simple animations and gestures. But at the same time, you know, given a lot of narrative weight, you know, given that you can form, you know, long-term relationships with them, it's a game mechanic that you're expected to uphold certain requirements of these relationships. I wonder, you know, it's interesting that you point to the sheer mechanics of the dog being what you what maybe kind of allowed you to make something of an emotional connection almost with it in its absence. I wonder, you know, what the potential might be for other game mechanics to function or to be interpreted as, you know, emotional or, you know, interpersonal mechanics that we don't necessarily equate on first notice.
Well, like, look at Passage. There, you meet a little female sprite character, and she starts following you around, and you grow old together, and then she turns into a tombstone. And she didn't really even do anything for you in the game. Like, there was no function, there was nothing important about her being in the game, other than that she followed you around and actually made it a little more difficult to navigate narrow spaces. But you'd gotten used to having her there, and you'd provided your own idea of a relationship to the fact that she walked with you, whether that was that she married you or you just common law married, or, I mean, you know, it was a long lost sister. It was entirely really up to you to determine what that relationship was. And then when it was taken away, it was difficult. It was an emotional moment. I don't think we by and large explore that enough in games. We take people away from you in a cutscene as motivation for going out and shooting more people in the head, not specifically usually to try and make you actually feel their loss on a real level. Like, we want to tell you that you feel sad, but we don't want to let you to actually allow you to feel sad while you're playing, because I don't know if that's because we still are pursuing games must be fun or what. But
Corus, do you think that tabletop RPGing allows that kind of, I don't know, more experiential, I'm trying to find the right word here, what you just said, with a video game authoring, makes me realize that the author is really not present in the experience of the narrative in the way that it is with a tabletop RPG session, even something, you know, as innocuous as Dungeons and Dragons, because, you know, the game master is there and is able to, you know, sort of manipulate and to even add improvise, as you said. I mean, it makes perfect sense to come to RPGing, that, at least in that way, from a performance background. And improvisation is absolutely key to moving the story forward in those senses, right? So do you think that that's a limitation for video games? Is that they've been, these narratives and these cutscenes and all of these plot devices have been scripted so many years in the past that they're kind of dead on arrival when the player interactor actually sees them and experiences them?
Well, I think, yeah. So one of the things I'm doing right now on my blog, the Semyonauts Notebook, is I'm exploring moments in games and saying, okay, so this is a developer moment where the developer is in complete control, and why are they doing that? And here's a moment where they're sort of sharing control with you, and what are the ways in which they can share control, and what's the degree of sharing? because I do feel that the video game author, I would disagree with you that they are there the entire time, except that it's usually a whole team of people, which dilutes sort of the purity of the vision, unless you've got a really strong vision at the head of that team, like a Peter Molyneux game or a Tim Schafer game, or a Will Wright game. So I think they are there, but the problem is A, it's a whole team of visions sort of contributing to the experience, which dilutes it, and B, games don't integrate well with pure authorial voices. And it's really easy to go, now I need to tell you a bit of the story. I'm going to take it all away from you after you've been emotionally invested in gameplay. I'm now going to strip gameplay from you and tell you something. So imagine if, you've got somebody with a Game Boy in their hand playing Tetris, the original Tetris, with the original music and the original, and you said, "Yep, stop a second. I want to tell you about communist Russia," and explain to them, like, they're going to go, "Shut up and leave me alone and let me play Tetris." And that's what happens in video games. Shut up and leave me alone. And so that's not true universally for everybody. And it's not true for every player, and it's not true for every player in every game. But I think by and large, what causes that difficulty of doing things in a meaningful way, story-wise, is that we shut down the player to do it ourselves. We can't trust you to participate in this emotional experience with us. I have to tell you what I think your emotional experience should be. Here it is. And that's great for movies and books, because we engage with those in a very different way than we do video games. But until we start taking our emotional content and putting it in the game mechanics itself, yeah, it's going to be perpetually a problem with video games.
That's interesting that you bring up those other mediums, because it strikes me that it might not be only not being trustful of the player to handle or to participate in that moment appropriately, but it's also not really trusting the medium itself to be able to deliver the content through its own devices, without hearkening back to these older forms of media that we're more familiar with.
Right. Yeah, and we don't have the training to do it within games. I mean, except we do. Our current culture does not have the training to do that with gameplay. But if you look back at the history of games, let's go back to what were the very first games played? They were races. And why were races some of the first games played? Because somebody went, I'm going to have to run away from a saber-toothed tiger someday. I think I should practice running. And somebody else said, "Hey, what are you doing?" "Oh, I'm running. I'm pretending to run away from a saber-toothed tiger." He goes, "Oh, that's a good idea. I'll bet I can do it better than you can." And then we have our first game, and there's this strong emotional component to it. So, games throughout our culture, they got more complex as social interactions got more complex, and our understanding of the dangers around us got more complex, and as we developed tools to deal with the dangers around us But they've always had an emotional quotient to them. And I don't know at what point we decided that gameplay didn't fill that function anymore. Because as we were just talking about with Monopoly and the Game of Life, clearly at the turn of the century, board games were still specifically trying to sort of create emotional experiences or meaningful experiences. And I don't know when we decided that wasn't the case. I don't know if it was the launch of digital media and we became so tech focused, and that it was those of us with, high functioning autistic tendencies who didn't like all of the emotional difficulty of other media, and we went, "Oh, good, computers, we can relate to those, and look, we can make computers challenge our reflexes and our skills and our logic and sort of abandon? I'm not sure. What do you guys think?
Well, I wonder if it's more when we saw games take a turn into, you know, very deliberate visual rhetoric. And when I remember, you know, when PC gaming revolutions that CD-ROM technology afforded us, where you could have, you know, like a, you could have Tim Curry, you know, playing, you know, Victor Frankenstein or something on your PC. And it's like, I see, that's a film actor and he's in a video game. Or in Wing Commander, when it's, you know, Mark Hamill, and it's like, oh, look, it's Luke Skywalker and he's in a video game. And like, oh, wow. So there's going to be this marriage between the two media. And I always wonder if it was a cohesive turn or not. I probably could argue with, but I guess. But the large point I want to make is, you know, did it kind of sell a little bit of itself, especially here in the U.S.? You know, did the medium of games dance too closely to the fire when it got sort of enraptured by aping film experiences?
You know, Heavy Rain comes out tomorrow, so we'll find out.
oh, good. I'm glad you brought that up. Has anybody here played the demo?
Oh, yeah.
So, Shane, you have? Mm-hmm. Sean, have you?
I haven't grabbed it. I don't turn on my PlayStation enough.
And Corvus, you're... Right, okay, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, that might be a really good example of the sort of, you know, bold, brash point I was going to try to make, but we could probably save that for later.
Like, I will say that I have been severely disappointed by previous efforts by Mr. Cage, and gave them both, I felt, really fair and earnest attempts to appreciate them. So it'll be interesting to hear reports from Heavy Rain, because I felt he's too... Ha ha, look at me, look how clever I'm being. Ha ha, ha ha, all throughout the whole gameplay. And that ruins it for me, because it's still, the focus is still on him as a storyteller, not on me as a storyteller.
Hmm. I appreciate you saying that, Corvus.
Yeah, I know Sean's got a little bit of a vendetta against...
I have always wanted to like the Quantic Dream games, and... I failed miserably at liking them the last two times. I imagine I'll have to check out Heavy Rain just to be sort of complete, but I don't know. I'm really not. It's not something that I'm looking forward to, you know, desperately or anything. I think that, you know, there's, to me, like, some of the greatest, you know, kind of storytelling in games, and this gets to kind of the cutscenes too that you were talking about, Trevor, are I always go back to the Abe's Odyssey games and Michel Ancel's Beyond Good and Evil. Like, to me, those are like really stellar examples of games doing things that aren't really all that interesting from a gameplay mechanics point of view, but they employ all of those mechanics in the service of a narrative that's put together really quite well, you know, both at like a technical level as well as at a conceptual narrative level. And they end up delivering a complete package in and of themselves.
Yeah, that's interesting, because so like a lot of people just assume that I'm completely anti-text in my games. Corvus doesn't want dialogue trees, and Corvus doesn't want cutscenes, which is a fair reaction to the things that I say, because when I start complaining about storytelling in games, I'm usually complaining about dialogue trees, and I'm usually complaining about cutscenes. But I loved the original Abe's Odyssey games, and I loved Beyond Good and Evil, and I didn't mind the cutscenes in either of those at all. Because, as you say, the gameplay was in good service to them, and they were characters that I cared about and felt were consistent with between gameplay and cutscenes. Like, I didn't feel that they were doing anything in the cutscene that wasn't supported by the gameplay. And in particular, Abe, where, you know, you can make Abe laugh. So you can have an Abe that maybe he was a little mean sometimes and would laugh when he walked a slig into a gun trap, or, you know what I mean? Like, you had some chance opportunities for emotional expression through gameplay there, through the game mechanics. that were completely irrelevant to solving the game, but they were very, very relevant to helping you build an emotional experience within the game.
Mm-hmm. You know, before we get too late in the interview, I want to make sure that we set some time out aside to talk about your project with the Honeycomb engine, Corvus. Can you give us a brief introduction to that?
So, yeah, so I mentioned that I've, you know, been gaming since 1989 and kind of using my own systems that entire time. They used to be sort of cobbled together from various other systems, and I at one point got them really reduced down to, like, we had two numbers on a character sheet, and then we just forgot about numbers altogether, and things got really out of control, narratively speaking, and I realized you needed a good system to support that kind of storytelling, or people would be thumbing their nose at the Emperor and wandering under that consequence because they knew that you liked their character just as much as they did and weren't about to, you know, just arbitrarily kill them if you didn't have numbers to... Anyway, so I took a bit of a break and I started creating a system that I felt would sort of support quality storytelling, that would be really easy to learn, that could for the most part be talked about within the story space itself. So you could actually, instead of having to take a bunch of time to sit down and read the rules and understand them, you could introduce characters to sort of a mentor character who would talk to them about the way the world works and how their bodies were comprised out of elements. And you could sort of do all of the training about the system within the context of the story world. And it's undergone a lot of variations over the last 10 years. And I think it was a little under two years ago. I don't know. Some time ago, sometime before now, I got rid of all written numbers in the system, really. And it uses tokens that represent a character sort of exerting energy in the world to perform actions. And you exert some of your will, which is a limited resource that each character has, into mastery. And then you roll a die to sort of incorporate the idea of fate, and the rest of the world, the rest of the systems in the story world itself. And based upon that die roll, you get to describe the success or failure of your own action. And so each spinner, to sort of throw things on their ear, instead of having a game master who is the master and controls everything, and then players, I have spinners and weavers, and the spinners each spin out a story thread that is their character, and it's the weaver's job to take all the threads spun by the spinners and weave them into a compelling sort of meta-narrative and to deal with the plot. So it also sort of reverses that responsibility there, too. Usually are damning to the GM's machinations, and this kind of reverses that a little bit. So we ought to be working with the spinner's drive and what the spinners want to do. But so using very simple systems and using sort of very evocative names for the mechanics, created a system that's not pinned to any one world. It's not necessarily trying to convey, you know, one set experience that's mine. And I've used it successfully for everything from, like, martial arts, teen martial art monster hunter campaigns to spinster old lady detective campaigns. And it's been really fascinating to sort of go through this process of creating this and getting it down to a point where pretty much anybody can sit down, whether they've gamed before or not, whether they've done any role-playing before or not, and just find themselves using the system successfully without having to have a lot of thick manuals to read and comprehend and understand. And we never have to stop mid combat and look up a rule for a weapon to make sure that somebody's not, you know, trying to cheat by having it have 7 damage instead of 6, which, like, I don't know. If you've ever done any role playing, there's certain things that just happen during role playing, rules lawyering things. And I've actually watched game masters stop and rules lawyer their players during combat. Mm-hmm. No, that is not a 7. And this was a literal thing. The guy thought his cyber shotgun should do 7 points of damage on a multi, and it only did 6. And like, we had to stop and prove him wrong before we could continue. And things like that drive me crazy. Like, that's not fun, really, I don't think, for most people. Not at a game level, anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I've really sought to sort of work around that and create a system where everybody can use it successfully.
Corvus, do you think that there are certain stories that are better served by the Honeycomb engine than others? Or not, better served isn't the right phrase there. Let me rephrase it this way. What has been the best narrative experience that you've had with this in all the playtesting you've done with it over the last few years? Because you were talking about, you know, the detective spinster story and the sort of hack and slash games. I mean, what is the single best narrative experience that you've had in playtesting this so far?
So there have been a lot of great ones. And so my first thought is it's kind of hard to narrow it down, but I think the one that's most representative of the flexibility of the system is I was at PAX, and I was set up in the hallway. So we're in a public space, and there were some people that wanted to play, and Deirdre Kiai, who's a game developer in Canada that's a friend of mine, had asked me the night before, like, she wanted to use RPG systems that did things like Jane Austen novels, or like, why couldn't we do non-traditional storytelling with role-playing systems? And I said, well, that's the kind of thing I want you to be able to do with the Honeycomb engine. And so when we sat down at the table, we were sitting down with someone who's getting his MFA in creative writing. And he had never done any role-playing before. And he said, Corvus, could you use the Honeycomb engine to do something like Hills Have White Elephants? Mm. And someone else at the table said, like, what? And so he explained that Hills Like White Elephants is, you know, it's a conversation between two people who aren't talking about what the subject matter of their conversation is. And it becomes clear that they're talking about an abortion, and if I'm recalling that correctly, but they never actually come right out and talk about the abortion. And I said, you know, okay, so I have two people sitting down at this table wanting to game right now, both of whom want to do something very, very, very different with the role-playing system. So instead of doing my, you know, Dickensian thieves in training session, which I usually give people when they sit down to game with me for the first time because it's short and contained and fun. So let's create a variant of my system right now, and I'll come up with something dramatically different. So instead of using the combat mechanics to do physical combat, we ended up quickly interpreting the combat systems as dialogue systems. So we were timing when you could respond and how you had to sort of pass off things where the other person had to help you perform an interaction. And if it was successful on your end, they had to work with you to make it successful for you. And I gave each character a secret shame about themselves and a suspicion about another character. And the setting was a funeral of their last, these four siblings at the funeral of their last remaining parent, who had just passed away after being in a coma for a year after a fatal car crash that had killed their father. So their mother just died. And so they each had a suspicion about another one, and they each had something about themselves they didn't want to reveal. And so four people who did not know each other before this weekend sitting in public, learning a new gaming system, or gaming for the first time even. And we sat down to play this, and you could tell everybody was a little hesitant. They weren't really sure. And as we started playing and people started getting comfortable, and we got to the final point where someone sort of realized they wanted to bear their shame. They wanted to reveal their shame. And so they sort of orchestrated things to come up into conflict with someone who was successful in a role so that they could reveal the secret that they were afraid of revealing. And it was a really emotional moment. Like, everybody sitting at the table, including a couple people who weren't actively playing, were really emotionally invested in these characters in a public con with all of these things that should have made it a really unsuccessful experience. We managed to tap into something and develop sort of a trust together in doing this storytelling moment. And that's when I knew I was really ready. You know, there've been a couple of small refinements since that point, but that's when I knew I needed to go ahead and publish, that I was ready to like start getting it out there and having other people see what other people would do with it.
Definitely interested to see the ways that it's implemented down the line by other people as you get it further and further out there away from yourself. That'll be cool.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I'm, like I said, instead of trying to sort of create this cage that constrains your experience, I'm trying to create a platform that people can build on. And I'm going to include some examples. The early version of the handbook is out there right now online at honeycombengine.com, but it's really written more almost like a design document. And there have been a couple of substantive changes since that went live. But the new handbook I'm writing has a lot of sort of example play, showing people cooperating. But then we're also going to talk about ways you can change the system to make it work for you in unusual ways. But it isn't what I've done with it that really excites me. Like you said, it's going to be really fascinating to me to see what people do with it when it's 2 or 3 or 4 degrees removed from me. And I hope that I, you know, get an opportunity to find out where people take it.
Can you talk a little bit about how you design the physical, board and pieces, and getting that stuff out into the world? Because, you know, the theoretical output, you know, is a lot of times really easily, well, not easily, but it's best handled, you know, by writing a manual, and then that's pretty easily disseminated. But it's a lot harder to have people download physical objects onto their computers, at least still like today in the, you know, 2010. So when you go about building physical objects or designing physical objects that people will end up ordering or picking up in a game store or whatnot, I mean, what sort of concerns do you have about that kind of distribution?
So this is kind of a first for me to be even contemplating doing this, because originally I thought everything was going to be online and you know, you just download and print out an 8.5 by 11 sheet and fill in some dots or write some numbers. But visual clarity, so like needing to know a lot about graphic design was really important. And additionally, the life wheel itself needed to make sense visually, because I'm really, it has to be intuitive. So once you have a basic idea of how the system works, the physical design of the board itself needs to correlate with that. I'm going to be trying to get them officially like nicely printed as a game board, because I think there's something very kinesthetically appealing. Like, so that's one of the things I keep coming back to about the Honeycomb Engine, is because you're picking up tokens and moving them. There's a tactile relationship suddenly, and you're pushing energy tokens out from the center of the board So it's very easy to sort of imagine that you're taking energy from within your character and expending it outward to perform actions. And that kinesthetic sense is really important to me. And you not having to like stop and look all around the board for what you're doing is really important to me. So I worked really hard. Each influence has a symbol that is sort of evocative of the meaning of that influence. So like slight, for example, I have a silhouette of a person with a cup and ball game in front of them. So there's three cups and one of them you can see has a ball in it, which is very representative of the types of things you can do with slight, both the sort of agility of your wit. So if you know the cup and ball game, mm-hmm. it's like the three card Monty, mm-hmm. Where's the lady? So it's evocative of the types of actions you might take with the influence of sleight, both the trickery and the manual dexterity hand-eye coordination. I don't know, is that answering your question?
Yeah, just the sort of design concerns more than just the kind of nuts and bolts of actually having something manufactured.
Right.
So yeah.
So clarity was big for me. Mm-hmm. And people have said, "Oh, you could just print those out on paper and laminate them and sell them that way." And I'm like, it's not going to feel quite as solid. Like when I started using the tokens, that I was essentially creating a board game to support the role playing experience, as opposed to try to emulate it, which a lot of more and more board games are doing. We have World of Warcraft board game and. Mm-hmm. Magic the Gathering, whatever. But this is more designed to. It needs to be something sort of substantial that people will take pride in owning. Like there needs to be that sort of I feel this feels good in my hand. It's got weight. It's got substance. This represents me in the game world. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want it to be something that's like flimsy. I feel. And so I'm also spending a lot of time figuring out what I'm going to do for the tokens because I want them to. Feel good in the hand and sound good when they drop on the board. I try to tell people, I was actually having a discussion with a young role play RPG designer in the area. And I said that rolling a die is substantively different experience than, and affects the gameplay differently than if you have them draw a random card from a stack of 10 mm-hmm. cards or whatever. They're like, no, it's exactly the same because your odds are, and they started talking about all the math and the odds and that. And I said, but it's not the same because culturally when we roll a die and we hear a die clatter across the table, that says luck to us. That's, there's something about that. You know, Frank Sinatra songs come to mind, Vegas crap games. There's so much wrapped up in that. We think if we blow on the die or we flick our wrist in a certain way when we let go of the die, we're influencing what's going to happen. We're altering the odds. But when you draw a card out of a deck, it doesn't really quite have the same feeling unless it's a big, heavy, thick sort of tarot-like card, in which case that has other cultural significance. He said, yeah, but that doesn't change the game. I'm like, absolutely it changes the game because it changes the way people play your game. It changes the way they think of it and the way they relate to it emotionally. So it might not change the rules or the mechanic, but it changes the way your player relates to the mechanic. And it's so important in any game to think about that. How will this be experienced by the player when they sit down? How is it going to affect the way they perceive what's going on and the systems they're being involved with?
This episode, I want to make sure and thank again Corvus Elrod for taking the time to sit down and join us to talk a little bit about your life experiences as a gamer and and what you're doing to expand our expectations of that space. And just really appreciate you coming on tonight, Corvus. Thanks again.
I really appreciate you guys having me here. Thank you so much.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. And we definitely need to get you back on in the future. We need to make sure that we send people to your blog at corvus.zekhelro.com. It's, you can go to firstwallrebate.com to find the link, so I don't have to spell that out. But yeah, and where you can also find links to Honeycomb Engine, which is at honeycombengine.com, easily enough. So definitely hope people will take the time to check that out. As for us, I think we've got some more guests on the date book, so we should be hopefully coming back with more episodes in the near future. And as always, I'm Shane Hinton.
Hey, I'm Trevor.
And I'm Sean.
And thank you, everybody, so much for listening. We hope to see you again soon.
I had a quick question to follow up on that you're explaining what happened at PAX. An MFA student came up and wanted to ask you about Hills. Did you think that person was being facetious? Were they generally trying to